You're listening to Vatican Radio, bringing the voices of Catholic women leaders from around the world to the heart of the Vatican is the goal of an event taking place in the Vatican on Wednesday to mark International Women's Day. The annual Voices of Faith event is jointly organised by the Fidel Gertz Foundation and by Jesuit Refugee Services, focusing this year on women working for justice and peacemaking in countries across the globe. Flavia Agnes is one of those who has been on the front line of this struggle in her native India. She's a lawyer and co-founder of the Majlis Legal Centre in Mumbai for marginalised women and children. A victim of domestic violence herself, Flavia has campaigned tirelessly to bring women's rights to the forefront of her country's legal system. She talked to me about the work of her centre, saying that while women continue to suffer from the invisible scourges of domestic and sexual violence, her country has seen much progress for women at the political and economic level. Tell us a little bit about this centre, how it started.
Well, it started 25 years ago. The main aim of the legal centre is to provide access to justice to women, because we have many laws protecting women's rights, but accessing those laws is very difficult because you don't know how to find a lawyer. Lawyers are expensive. The whole legal process can be very exploitative, and it's beyond the reach of vulnerable and marginalized people. So the whole idea was to have a center where women are able to access justice. So that was the purpose, particularly for victims of domestic violence and for victims of sexual violence.
Now, I understand that your desire to set up this centre grew out of your own experience
that
of this
right.
kind of violence. Can you share some of that with us?
Yeah, I actually grew up in a small city on the western coast of India called Mangalore, which is predominantly Roman Catholic. So I come from a very strong Roman Catholic tradition. And then after my marriage, I came to the larger city, which is Mumbai. I got married as per the arranged marriage style prevailing in India to a person of my same community. But that marriage turned out to be a very violent marriage. There's a lot of physical violence, and I endured it for 13 years.
13 years?
Yeah, and I had 3 children in that marriage. When I turned for help within the church, within the community, everywhere you are told that, you know, this is your destiny, you're supposed to adjust. This is what the church teaches you. But the violence was so severe and so humiliating, and I felt that it could not be the religion that's mandating that you suffer like this.
Your husband was beating you or your children? Or
my husband was beating me immediately soon after my marriage, and it continued for a very long time. And it came as a total shock to me because I didn't realize that domestic violence was such an integral part of marriage, and particularly a Christian marriage at that. But I didn't know where to turn for help.
How old were you at the time?
I got married when I was 20. And when I left, I was 33 years. So you go to church, you talk to the priest, you talk to people you think will be able to help you. But everywhere you are told the same thing, there's no way out of it. And it was very, not only demeaning for me, but also I felt very wrong to bring up children in such a violent environment. Because what is the lesson they are going to get? What is the message you are going to give to the next generation? And it becomes a cycle of violence from generation to generation. And somehow I had to break it.
So how did you find the way out?
So in 1980, the women's movement started in a very small way in India, also in Mumbai where I live. And somehow I came to know about it. I joined that group. And when I joined that group, even in that group, nobody knew about domestic violence that happens in ordinary middle-class homes. You think that it happens in the lower class, but you never think that it happens in almost all homes. Today, there's a much better realization about what happens, what is domestic violence, where it happens. But in 1980, we only thought of extreme violence like rape or dowry death, because dowry was a major issue for India. So you thought only these two kind of violence that happen. But that, as a term, domestic violence that happens in middle-class homes across all classes was not recognized. And it was totally a secular group. there are hardly any Roman Catholics in that group. But I found that my story became very credible over there, that people were believing and people were telling me that we will support you if you want to opt out of that.
And you managed to get out of the marriage.
I managed to get out. I had to leave everything. In a sense, I had no financial support. I took my daughters with me. I had to leave my son behind because I didn't have the resources. And I opted for poverty. And I thought to myself that anything is better than being in a situation like this. And then I was not educated, but I had just a high school diploma. And after that, I had got married. So I had to like educate myself, get graduation, be independent, start working, and support the children, and do the legal case for a child support, etc. So this was a Herculean task, and that went through 1980 to 1990. By the time 1990, I had become a lawyer. And that's when I set up this organization, so that whatever I had learned in the process of negotiating the legal system, if I could help other women to do that. And that's how it was set up.
How much would you say that India has changed today? How much progress has there been in stamping out this kind of domestic violence?
I think there's considerable change. We have, firstly, there's change within the church. At the time, divorce was not permitted to women, even under the Christian law, which is under the state. We have different laws for Muslims and Christians and Hindus. But the Christian law was the most aggressive in terms of not permitting divorce for women on the ground of domestic violence, on the ground of cruelty. It was very stringent English law of the last century.
Left over from the colonial rule.
Yes, absolutely. You had to have two grounds, like adultery and cruelty, or adultery and desertion. And if your husband was not adulterous, cruelty alone was not a ground for divorce. But I worked very hard to change the law. And in 2001, the law got changed and the church had to agree for the change of law. The state would not change this law governing Christians, though it was a state law, unless the Roman Catholic Church approved of it. So we negotiated with the church, negotiated with the state, because meanwhile, many of us had challenged this law in the court. And the court had struck down state by state, but it's not a central legislation. So a lot of maneuvering within the church and the state we had to do. And finally, we got the law changed in 2001. And 2005, we got a law for exclusively for domestic violence, protection of women from domestic violence. And that law is applicable across all communities. So which provides protection for women, which protects the shelter, that, you know, husband cannot say, I'll throw you out of my house because the house belongs to me. So these are the legal changes that have come about. But if you see on the ground level, these are very illusory. They're only a certain class of people can access it. Accessing the law is very difficult. The litigating process is very challenging in the courts. And law promises a lot of things, but they don't happen on the ground. So the work of my organization is a twofold. That one is to help women access the justice system, but at the level to find out the lacuna, why it is not working, and bring it to the notice of the High Court or the state policy level to say this must change in order for the law to work better for women.
How easy is it to do that, to reach women, as you say, at grassroots level, where many of them, I imagine, are probably illiterate, many of them have no idea that they have protection from this kind of violence?
There's been a big campaign and a lot of groups are working in creating awareness on the ground about laws that are there. I live in a major city. I live in Mumbai. So Mumbai is in that way very dynamic. There are lots of non-governmental, non-profit organizations that do work in creating awareness at the grassroots level. But at the same time, there are very few organizations that help women to litigate, to help women to go to court. So creating awareness is one thing, but having a group of lawyers which will help women to go to court is another thing. And we have a legal aid, but the legal aid is absolutely doesn't function. So where we work is to be there to understand the law, to help women to access it, but also help other state agencies who are supposed to help women to function better. So like the legal aid services, the courts, the judges, you have to constantly do the training with them because unless the state system works, even if my NGO works better, it is of no use. You have to make the, to bring in the largest changes, you have to change the system.
And how much do you think that your work is changing the system and is really changing the culture? Because we still hear a lot about the problems facing women. We hear about child brides, huge numbers of child brides, or female infanticide. In other words, the status of women is still considered very much second class, isn't it, in India?
Actually, India has made a lot of progress in so many other directions. In this whole gender index, if you see globally, India's progress in political participation of women, we have 1/3 reservation for women in the local councils, the municipal councils, municipal corporations, local panchayats, village level tribunals, etc. Women are participating in those. If you see political participation, India is doing very good. If you see education is another indicator, we are doing considerably well. Also in economic, women's economic participation, though not at a very high level, very few women are there, so we still have the glass ceiling, but otherwise women are entering the job market, being entrepreneurs and are doing everything. Where we're lacking, far behind means we are like around the 3rd or 4th from the bottom, is violence against women. Health and violence indicators, we are consistently falling. Despite everything else that we try to do, the status of women in India and the violence that is inflicted upon women is of such scale that whatever efforts that one makes, it's not even a drop in the ocean. We have right from female feticide to female infanticide, to child marriage, trafficking issues, human trafficking, sex trafficking, to domestic violence, to dowry harassment, to dowry death, to widows, stigmatizing of widows and humiliation of widows. We have it, all of it. And I think somewhere the whole South Asian culture is terribly anti-women.
How do you change that? What else can you do?
So as far as the laws are concerned, we are on par with any progressive nation. For instance, we have laws on domestic violence, sexual violence, child sexual abuse, trafficking, everything we have lost. But if you see the social attitudes, which we have the ground level reality, it has not reached at all. I mean, the changes are so insignificant. It, like, I live in a city of Mumbai, which is like one of the major cities. Even here, if you see the attitude towards women, you hardly see any change. And women are, though women have money, though women are working, still within the domestic sphere, there is so much of male domination and so much of female subordination.
And yet we did see an extraordinary strong reaction to those cases of rape just fairly recently. We saw people coming out and protesting, and quite a lot of awareness around that.
It was a case of the woman from our middle class and the boys were from the lower class. So there was anger about the lower class and the gruesome violence. It was the violence of such a high degree where the girl ultimately died. So against it, there was protest. But if you see today, the cases that are coming up, the sexual violence happening in our home, happening in our neighborhood, it happens on everyday life. The way the girls are exploited, the girls are made pregnant on the promise of marriage, the way the elders in the family abuse the daughters, the young children in the family, all this is invisible. It's only coming out now that a few cases, because it is mandatory reporting, that any sexual activity below 18 is considered as rape as per the new law. But if you see, you could see girls of 12, 13, 14, 15 pregnant, and they don't even know how they got pregnant. So when they go to hospital for any problem and they're tested pregnant, then a case of rape is registered. It could be the father who's done this abuse. It could be an uncle. It could be any family relative member or a neighborhood boy. But in most of the cases, the name that the girl says, the DNA testing that we do, it does not match, because the girl may not be exploited by only one person. There must be a number of persons exploiting this girl.
What do you hope that this event here for International Women's Day, what do you hope it can achieve? Because it's very easy to talk about these issues for one day of the year or perhaps one week of the year, and then it's back to business as usual, isn't it?
This panel in which I will be speaking is called the Stirring of the Waters. So basically, the waters must be stirred. Otherwise, there's a whole passive complacency that is there in the church. And there's also a certain arrogance that, you know, like, we are the best and we do what is right. The church must know that what they're doing always is not right. And particularly where women's issues are concerned, we have not been doing the right thing. And it is necessary to bring in changes within the church for the church to be relevant. Now, there are also many local issues. Like, for instance, Christians are a minority in India, a small, insignificant minority. And we have today an extremely right-wing government, which is against minorities. And the minorities are Muslims and Christians. So for the church to understand that within the minority, there are issues regarding Muslim minority, but there are also issues regarding Christian minorities. Now, we need to understand and have a comprehensive framework how we negotiate the rights of minorities. The church needs to be much more vocal to speak for justice and to speak for people who, whether they are marginalized in any community, whether they're tribal, whether they are Muslims, whether they are Christians, who are these tribal communities, who are these marginalized people, and where are these women in these communities, and what is happening to women. I think our church needs to support our work much more strongly and vocally, and that is very important for us.
What gives you most hope in all this very difficult situation?
Well, there's always hope. You always work thinking, you know, that something is going to change tomorrow. And it's not that we have not seen changes even within the church. Like, you know, from where I started my struggle, when issues of domestic violence were not even recognized, either by the church or by the state. And in this last 30, 35 years, we can see the change that is happening regarding sexual violence, regarding domestic violence. But the problem is how much we have made advances legally. The numbers are not coming down. The statistics are not supporting us. So we need to, like, create far more awareness. There has to be change in mindset. Women have to be much more assertive about their own rights, about their own bodily integrity, and about not to be violated, not to allow themselves to be violated. Whether you are a nun, whether you are a layperson, whether you are a Christian, whether you are a non-Christian, in each and every sphere, women must have the confidence to fight for their rights. And only when women speak up and when women fight against this kind of violation that happens to them, can we move forward.